And here we are once again as the world continues to change. The world is transforming, and it's happening right here in China. It's happening, in fact, as we cover the story in this remarkable place. This is a 600-year-old palace. It's called the Han Palace. Goes all the way back to the Ming Dynasty. We are here. We are analyzing. We are bringing you today's developments, and it's all happening right here on the Sanchez Effect. Let's do this. And hello again, everybody. I'm Rick Sanchez. You know, sometimes I say to myself as a journalist, I want to tickle myself because I'm kind of excited. I'm like a kid in a candy store. I've never been in an environment where there's so much going on. Literally, quite literally, the world is being transformed. It's going from one power base, a hegemony, really, that's been that way since the end of World War II, where some countries in the West, like the UK and Germany and France, and of course, the country where I hail from, the United States, have pretty much been in control and have been telling everyone what to do. Those countries that they have been telling what to do have finally said, you know, we're kind of tired of being told what to do. So we're going to come together and we're going to form our own power base. That power base for a long time has been called the Global South Community. But something's happening here. And this is what it really is so fascinating. The name has changed. I mean, if this were a moniker and the moniker were Global South, guess what it's being called now? It's now being called the Global Majority, the Global Majority. And to understand this, you have to understand the things by which we use to measure nations and certainly the totality of nations. So let me just talk about that for a minute, because I think it's important for the world to understand. And those of you watching in Western countries like the United States, for example, you have to do certain measurements. So let's just play around with some of those figures. And I'm not going to bore you with exact numbers. But if you look at things like, for example, what is the standing army of the countries that are here right now? Iran, Russia, India, China, Egypt, Pakistan, all these countries that are here, and you add up their standing armies, it is devastatingly higher than the countries from, you know, the old West, countries like Germany and the UK and the G7, et cetera, et cetera. Now look at GDP growth. In other words, how fast is the economy of a particular country growing? It's not even close. If you look, for example, at what's happening in India, somewhere over 6.5 to 6.8 GDP growth. China, 5%. Even Russia, 3.8%. Compare it to what's happening, for example, and this is the worst example, but in Germany, it's negative 0.2. You know, it's something like 1.2 in the UK and similar numbers all around. In fact, Russia right now, as a European country, has the highest GDP growth. So what basically has happened is all of these nations have come to this Shanghai Cooperative Summit to assert themselves. Now, here's the question. Did they assert themselves simply because, oh, what the heck, we got nothing else to do, and we've been friends for a long time, so let's get even a little closer? No. No. In fact, some of these countries have been antagonistic. China and India have not had an embraceful, loving relationship. They've had issues. They've had issues on the Himalayan border, as a matter of fact. Russia and China have had their spats in the past, also with India. So these countries that suddenly are here embracing each other and saying, by unifying, we are better, we are stronger, are doing that as a result of what they feel has been aggression from the West, right? It started essentially with what happened with Russia, where the West froze their assets, sanctioned them, tariffed them, did every possible castigatory measure that you can imagine, right? And then the second step was when the U.S. went even further and told India, you're not allowed to do business with Russia, to which India said, no, I'm sorry, we're going to do business with whoever the hell we want to do business with. And the world went, what just happened? The big bad wolf, maybe not so bad anymore, right? And that's kind of where we are. And since these countries have all come here, it seems like in the last 3 days, as we've been here covering this historic moment, we're seeing that if they came together with the idea that maybe we should do deals to become closer, they're actually getting even closer than we thought they were going to get. China and India are going to resume flights back and forth between their countries. China and India are going to come up with a deal to create a peace measure for that Himalayan conflict area that we've been talking about. China and India are talking about sharing natural resources, rare earth minerals, et cetera, something they wouldn't have done in the past. Mr. Xi is telling Mr. Modi, don't worry about the fact that the United States doesn't want to buy your products. We'll buy them. We got a whole bunch of people living over here who could use some of the stuff that you guys might buy, might sell. So, I mean, it sounds rudimentary, but these are some of the things that are happening in this relationship. In fact, today there's another bullet point, if you will, in terms of a better understanding of what's happening in the world, which is also transformational and significant. Take a look at this picture. This is Kim Jong-un of North Korea. He arrived today, and there he is with President Xi, and look who else is with him, President Putin. So you have North Korea, China, and Mr. Putin. And obviously, Mr. Putin wanted to be there because Mr. Putin was in a bit of a pickle when the Ukrainians tried to invade a part of Russia in the Kursk region. Mr. Putin called Mr. Kim Jong-un, and he supplied North Korean soldiers that somewhat shocked the world. But according to all reports from generals, Russian generals have said they performed courageously, admirably. And if it wasn't for them, we may not have been able to withhold that advance. See, that's a relationship issue which is just now starting to flourish, because Mr. Putin and Mr. Kim Jong-un just had a very long meeting talking about future relationships. And now, as a result of that relationship, Mr. Putin is introducing Mr. Kim Jong-un back into relationships potentially with China and with India and with Egypt and with the UAE and with Iran. And you see, I think in many ways what we're seeing happen here is countries that have felt dogged, literally dogged by the West, are now saying, we're not going to take it anymore, and we're going to come together, and we're going to be as big a power base as the West is. So, next question that you may have as you're listening to me tell the story of how we got where we are is the following. So what is the West doing? Are they watching this? And how are they reacting? Well, there's some in the traditional West, and by West I mean NATO and the EU, for example, who are actually dipping their toes in the water. Mr. Fico from Slovakia is coming here and saying, you know what, I'm thinking about being a part of this. Erdogan from Turkey, doing the same thing. He showed up and he's actually thinking about getting a membership. He wants to apply to this new country club, which apparently he likes it because the Greens are really good. He wants to possibly be a member of the SCO. These are fascinating transformational things. Think about what I just said. Countries that are members of NATO and the EU are thinking about moving into another sphere, joining another club, if you will. That's truly transformational, and those are some of the things that happen. So you want to know, though, I know many of you watching us are probably thinking, okay, Sanchez, so what's going on with the United States? Here's what's going on with the United States. Well, you know the things that Mr. Navarro has said. We called it the Navarro effect, right? He said some things that were slightly insulting about India in particular. But now Mr. Trump came out today, and he made a statement, which is kind of somewhat conflictive and contradictory. At first, he sounds like he's saying something nice because he wants to congratulate China on this event. But then he throws in a zinger, especially at Mr. Putin, which is fascinating, and I want you to listen to it. Here's the post that Mr. Trump put out earlier today.
The big question to be answered is whether or not President Xi of China will mention the massive amount of support and blood that the United States of America gave to China in order to help it to secure its freedom from a very unfriendly foreign invader. Many Americans died in China's quest for victory and glory. I hope that they are rightfully honored and remembered for their bravery and sacrifice. May President Xi and the wonderful people of China have a great and lasting day of celebration. Please give my warmest regards to Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un as you conspire against the United States of America.
Some people have compared Mr. Trump's comments to that of a jealous lover. Not sure if he's giving him a compliment or he's just mad that Mr. Putin is sharing the spotlight with Mr. Kim Jong-un, which would be somewhat contradictory for Mr. Trump as well, because 4.5 years ago, he was courting Mr. Kim Jong-un. So, look, the world is complicated. I want to bring somebody in. I want to tell you a little bit about the person that I'm going to be bringing in now before I introduce him to you. We are so lucky to have somebody with this kind. Listen to this. I'm going to read you a little bit of his curriculum vitae. I'm not going to bore you, but this is very fascinating. He worked at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs at the United Nations. He is a political advisor to the Hong Kong Securities and Futures Commission. He was an investment banker at Morgan Stanley. He is the chairman of the Yale Law School Association of China. He worked side by side and oftentimes as a translator to Chairman Deng Xiaoping of China. He is now a professor. Vice President Beijing-based Center for China and Globalization. To say that this is a man who is worldly and has lots of experience in many different areas and is the perfect guest to talk to about some of the things that we're explaining are so transformational in the world right now would be an understatement. I'd like to bring in Victor Gao, Chinese lawyer and academic, to joining our discussion. It's so good to see you.
Thank you.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you?
You look fantastic.
You are great.
Oh, you're too kind to say
Thank
that.
You.
What an amazing moment to be in this place. And you, perhaps better than anybody else, understand it. Not like the rest of us who are watching it happen now. You've seen it develop. You were in conversations with the government 10 years ago, telling them that this could be possible. Could you talk a little bit about what the foundation, what the genesis is of how China got to this place?
Well, I think China started to reform and opening to the outside world back in 1978. And ever since then, China has always been consistent in maintaining stability at home, keeping peace abroad, and treating development as the hard truth. Deng Xiaoping always said, develop, develop, develop. Development is the hard
truth. So Deng Xiaoping, in many ways, a gentleman you work for and know very well,
yeah.
You would say he's the founder of this modernistic movement in China?
I've called Deng Xiaoping the prophet for the Chinese nation. He basically charted a pathway forward at a time when few people in China could understand why he would do this. Because Deng Xiaoping came up with breakthroughs like socialism with Chinese characteristics. No, whether a cat is black or white is not the most important thing. The key litmus test is whether the mouse can catch mice, for example. All these things really opened us from this huge ideological box, bringing us out of the box into the open. And we started to embrace the world and embrace development and embrace innovation and creativity.
And how has it gone over with the Chinese people? I read a study recently that shocked me. I shared it with my viewers a few days ago where I said, in America, people feel less free today, and in China, people feel more free today. Is that as a result of that effort?
Absolutely. I would say when I grew up as a kid, there were very few books in English. Now, if you go to any bookstore or if you go online, books in English, in many other European languages, for example, in Japanese, Korean language, and also in Chinese language, they are in plentiful of supply. You can read anything if you want in China. That means you have the freedom of reading, freedom of gaining knowledge, freedom of talking to wonderful people like you, for example, and opening up our door to welcome every visitor from anywhere in the world. China has granted a visa-free to more than 40 countries, and hopefully more countries will get this special treatment from China. Come into China, meet with the Chinese, taste the Chinese food, see China as it is, and you will be enriched.
And that's happening, and yet there are still people in the United States, as led by certain politicians and certain members of the media, I won't name them, but I know they're there, and you do too, who still refer to this country, your country, as just a bunch of communists.
Well, it depends on how you define communism. In China, we call our system socialism with Chinese characteristics. So what is socialism?
Yeah.
Well, for a while, before 1978, we thought everything about capitalism must be bad. Everything about socialism must be good. But then we end up with some kind of poverty or lack of development. So people started to really split the hair into different pieces as to what exactly was the socialism, what exactly was capitalism. Deng Xiaoping came up and said, if socialism results in poverty, that's not a good political system. Hmm. But he says socialism must lead to abundance and prosperity. And I would call that socialism with Chinese characteristics. That's the beginning. That's the genesis of our reform.
I want to ask you about whether that reform is still in place. I was with a cab driver the other day who spoke beautiful English. So, of course, I did an interview with him. And I asked him, how do you feel about Mr. Xi compared to the previous leader? He said he liked the previous leader more, has nothing against Mr. Xi, loves Mr. Xi, loves the government. He wasn't overly critical, but he said that he liked the direction before. Does that surprise you that he would say that?
No, it doesn't surprise me. I think in China we have 1.4 billion people. Everyone has its own brain.
1.4 billion opinions.
Opinions, or maybe sometimes multiplied by two or three.
Right.
So everyone has his own opinion. And I think it will not be surprised. I would not be surprised if cab driver one says he likes Mr. So-and-so, the other one would love someone else, etc. But what really matters is whether China is continuously growing upward, gaining more popularity, gaining more wealth for the nation, and everyone is becoming richer. Richer today than before.
By far.
And hopefully richer tomorrow than yesterday.
But you're a market reform guy. I mean, you worked for Morgan Stanley. I mean, how much of a market guy can you be? Does China welcome these market reforms? Do they fit into the Chinese government model to have Apple all over the place and McDonald's and Burger King and Skechers and all of these corporations over here?
I would say without reform, China will be dead. And without democracy, there will be no modernization. So China wants to have democracy. We want to have reform. We want to have one reform after another. We can never be complacent. We can never say, oh, China's door is open wide enough, let's close it. No, it will never happen. You can never say, whatever China has is the best and has reached the pinnacle. No, we will never reach the pinnacle. We will always reform with the hope that China's tomorrow will be better than today, as China's today is better than yesterday. So we want to keep moving forward, keep reforming, keep opening up to the outside world.
You are such a wise man. I am so enjoying your words. You explain it so well. And I think in the end, this is what people want. They want us to have these types of conversation of someone with your experience and perhaps my own limited experiences so we can learn together. So many topics that we have to talk about. You and I are going to be talking about Mr. Modi. We're going to be talking about Mr. Putin. I'm going to ask you about Mr. Fitzo's comments. I'm going to ask you about Turkey's involvement, wanting to be a part of this organization. Obviously, Mr. Modi's going to be a part of this. But I want to start with something which, you know, I would be remiss if we didn't start the conversation with what I saw today. It was hard to take my eyes off of the screen. Gene, can you play some of these pictures of this victory parade so perhaps Victor and I could have a conversation about it? This was so precise, so beautifully orchestrated. And as I looked into the eyes of the people here, we're seeing weaponry now. And, you know, China, like every other country, wants to show that it's strong. Don't mess with us. Look what we got kind of thing. But even beyond the weaponry, the eyes of the people, the eyes of the performers, the acts, the songs, they were so emotional, so passionate. It didn't seem like they were faking it. It seemed very genuine.
Very genuine.
What
very
is genuine. It?
I think in China, as you can see on the faces of these young people, people are proud. We take great pride in China today. We take great pride in Chinese civilization, having a history of more than 5,000 years, if not even longer. We take great pride of China overcoming all the odds and overcoming all the challenges and pulled ourselves out of poverty and achieved one of the highest level of industrialization and modernization and urbanization in modern history. So if there is no one taking great pride in China's great transformation and great achievements, I'd be shocked. I think we are proud people. And we want to share our pride with the rest of the world. We want to make sure that China's weapons, the advanced technologies, are not used for war. They are used for maintaining peace,
yeah,
defending peace, and peace for everyone in the world. So when we see the Chinese president coming out of the gate, reviewing the Chinese troops, etc., greeting and exchange greetings with the soldiers and officers, mm-hmm. it's a proud moment for all of us. I'm very proud. I was doing live interview in the CCTV headquarters,
yes,
while the parade is taking place. I was really a very proud Chinese this morning.
World War II, the defeat of Japan, that's really what this is all about. And it's certainly an important time. You know, oftentimes in the West, World War II is something that nobody even remembers. It's not even really celebrated anymore in the United States. There's no victory parade in the West. They have an event in Normandy every year, and for the most part, China and Russia and all these countries are barely even invited. So there's almost an antagonism in terms of not understanding who played a significant role in this. For example, and let me just say this, as an American, I almost want to apologize for my Western colleagues and friends who have chosen not to be here. Why not? Why not?
I would say it's a shame that they did not show up in Beijing on this very important day. I would say history will record it very clearly.
Yeah.
For defeating Nazi Germany in Europe and Japanese fascism in Asia-Pacific region, the former Soviet Union, the predecessor of Russia today, and China did the most heavy lifting. We sacrificed the most. In China, our sacrifices involved 33 million people,
wow,
soldiers as well as civilians. And we
Mostly civilians.
Yeah. And we fought the longest. For the United States, the war against Japan started after Pearl Harbor for a totality of less than 4 years. We fought against the Japanese aggressors for 14 years in a row.
Yeah.
China refused to surrender. China refused to be enslaved by the Japanese fascism.
Yeah.
And we fought to the very end. And the fact that the United States eventually declared war on Japan after the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor really accelerated the downfall of Japanese
fascism.
And
my country did a great thing by entering the war and committing itself.
Former Soviet Union.
Nothing to be ashamed of, right.
Attacking the Japanese troops in Manchuria, in China's northeastern part of China. And that all accelerated the ultimate unconditional surrender of Japan in this part of the world. So when we look back at the Second World War, when we look at the world anti-fascism war, we think about the former Soviet Union. We think about the Red Armies, for example, and the brutalities, atrocities committed by Nazi Germany against the Soviet people of different ethnicities, as well as the enslavery of so many countries in Europe. But we focus on the atrocities committed by the Japanese fascists here in our country. And together with the United States, of course, we overcame all the odds and defeated Nazi Germany and fascist Japan.
So one would wonder then what would be wrong with together not celebrating this incredible achievement when there was a sense of teamwork between China and Russia and the UK and the countries of Europe and the United States. Why not celebrate that right now? Even if you don't agree with what's going on at the SCO summit, come to the parade, watch it, and then get on the plane and leave.
Exactly.
Send a representative, right?
Exactly. But I would not be surprised if all the ambassadors in China, we have 183 foreign countries' embassies here, and we have about 30 international organizations headquartered, and with their regional headquarters here in China, they sent their representatives to attend the parade.
Hmm.
That's for sure, probably with only one exception, that is Japan. Japan probably didn't send its ambassador or military attaché to the parade, etc., for its own reason. I do not want to go into details of that.
Well, what do you think of that?
Well, I think Japan didn't acknowledge that they lost the war. They thought they lost the war because of the two nuclear bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki.
Hmm.
The reality was that Japan lost the war before the two atomic bombs.
Yeah.
The United States dropped the two bombs in order to accelerate the process of Japan's downfall and prevent the former Soviet Union gaining more victories against Japanese fascists.
Yeah.
But that's a minor chapter in history. I think to celebrate the defeat of Japanese fascism is the most honorable thing to do in the world of today as well as in the foreseeable future to come.
Let's talk about some of the events that have been taking place here. Maybe Maybe I start with this one. There was an understanding that was made yesterday between China, Mongolia, and Russia, where they are now going to use a pipeline, as you well know, perhaps some of the most amount of natural reserves of oil and gas is in Siberia, and that's generally Russian territory. And the Russians have now agreed with the Chinese and Mongolia to continue to develop the pipeline, which is going to take the oil from Siberia through Mongolia all the way to China. It almost looks like the decisions that are being made here right now, and we're looking at the map right there, as it goes from Siberia and Russia through Mongolia all the way into China, and China is embracing this, and it almost looks like there's a paradigm shift. As you know, in business, it used to be the best model for consumerism was in Europe. Russia's now saying, you don't want our oil? Fine. We're going to look to the east and do deals with these countries. How significant is that?
Well, I would say for Europeans, it is a shame that they give up a relatively inexpensive piped gas from Russia in lieu of in exchange for very expensive liquefied natural gas from the United States, because the cost differential will most likely make European advanced manufacturing out of market.
Yes.
Because it will increase their overall cost significantly. So I would appeal on the European countries to use their brain, to use their own judgment to decide.
But shouldn't pardon me for interrupting, but shouldn't their leaders, what you just said is brilliant. And it seems to make all the sense in the world. If you have a manufacturing base that's way down, which it is, and you want to increase it, make sure that they can get their raw goods at a lower price so that they can increase the manufacturing. If you increase the price of their raw goods, it's going to be harder for them to make and sell their products.
Exactly. I'm ashamed to see some European leaders say, we no longer want to have
but
Russian gas.
But how could they not? Victor, how could they? When they make this decision to not accept Russian oil, they're punishing their own people.
Exactly. This is exactly the point. They say we no longer need Russian gas, Russian oil. We can use American oil, American gas. But they fail to tell the European people that piped gas, as a matter of fact, is normally only half of the cost of the liquefied natural gas. In many cases, liquefied natural gas is three times, if not four times, and in some cases, five times or six times as expensive as piped gas. That's the truth they fail to tell the European people. They are basically put on such a burden on European economy, European manufacturing, for years, if not for decades to come.
Yeah.
This is really pushing the European economy into kind of a corner or even into bankruptcy.
And by the way, the hat that you're putting on right now while you're explaining this to us is not the hat of a Chinese communist. It's the hat of an investment banker for Morgan Stanley.
I'm an investment banker. I'm a private equity practitioner. So, I've done many things. I know how to make money in an honorable and decent way and how to avoid putting cost onto your own people.
And you admit to it and you do it proudly. Let me show you something now, because not all of Europe is blind to some of the mistakes from a business standpoint that are being caused there. This week we saw, as a matter of fact, we saw the president of Turkey, Mr. Erdogan, came here. He's actually, you know what he's doing? He's actually asking if his application will be accepted for his country to become a part of SCO, which I found somewhat outlandish that he would say that, because I think by doing so, he's sending a message to his peers and colleagues, you know, in the EU and in the in NATO and around Europe, that the world is shifting, and he recognizes it, even if they don't. But another European leader, this is the leader of Slovakia, Mr. Fico, came here yesterday and said some words that I thought were also somewhat transformative and very stern. You want to listen to it? I think we got it, Gene. Let's play Fico if you got it.
A new world order is being created, new rules for a multicultural world, a new balance of power, which is extremely important for international stability. Being part of such discussions means encouraging dialogue and not playing the role of an offended little child. This is somehow how the EU and its leaders behave today. The EU is just like the frog at the bottom of the well, who thinks that the sky it sees from there is the entire sky. and we are happy with ourselves, which is extremely embarrassing.
It's like the frog at the bottom of the well who looks up and thinks he's seeing all the sky, but he's only seeing a piece of it. What do you make of that?
Well, I would say Mr. Fico is a great, courageous, brave, and wise European statesman.
Yeah.
I think he mentioned one thing. He said, throughout the Second World War, Soviet Union and China did the most heavy lifting, sacrificed the most in defeating Nazi Germany in Europe and Japanese fascism in Asia. This is a well-said statement which reflects the realities on the ground. And the fact that he wanted to overcome all odds and travel to China to attend this victory parade shows that Europeans still have some independence of mind. They still have some great brain power existing somewhere in Europe in the form of this great leader from Slovakia. And he did the European leaders should have done. And I think we cheer the prime minister or the Slovakian leader, and we hope China-Slovakia relations will grow in great abundance in the future. And other European leaders, I hope, I'm an eternal optimist, sooner or later, we'll need to come to Beijing to attend the future V-Victory parade in the future.
Let me ask you about Vladimir Putin. I mean, he's a wild, wily guy, I think. I think he knows exactly what he's doing. And I think you have to give him some level of credit, whether you are a fan of his or his political chicanery or not. You have to give him credit for really being... He has spearheaded this turn that we're seeing right now, I think, my humble opinion. I think when the Americans and the EU and NATO and the rest of the Western world look to Russia and say, we're going to bury you, we're going to close, we're going to steal your boats, we're going to take your oligarchs' yachts. We're going to freeze your assets. We're going to freeze your money. We're going to take that money and we're going to give it to your to Ukraine so they can buy more weapons to attack you. We're going to sanction you. We're going to tear. I mean, what didn't they do to this country? And yet the country said, we will survive, you know, like Gloria Gaynor in the song. We will survive. And they have. And I think, Victor, I think, and I've said this before, I think what Russia did by withstanding all of that, gave a sense of confidence to the other Global South community members that said, maybe if they can do it, we can do it too. Am I right?
Well, I would say if we look at the Alaska summit meeting, President Putin is a big winner. Russia is a big winner. President Trump is also a big winner.
Why?
Ukraine is a big loser. Europe as a whole is a big loser. Why? Let me talk about President Putin and Russia first. I think after suffering all these more than 16,000 sanctions imposed on Russia, Russia didn't collapse. Russia managed to pull through and gained, as you mentioned, a relatively speaking high GDP growth rate and stabilized the situation and single-handedly fighting off not only Ukraine, but all those countries behind Ukraine, which want to use Ukraine as a proxy. Try to, for example, bankrupt Russia or to push Russia over through an abyss. No, Russia didn't fall apart. Yeah. That means at the Alaska meeting, Russia and President Putin emerged as the real winners because President Trump showed him the maximum courtesy and the politeness, and they had a private chat, for example, 3-3, etc. And eventually they agreed on many things, actually. Yeah. What has been disclosed probably was only a fraction of what they talked about in private. That means, that leads to my conclusion.
Yes.
There will be no lasting peace in Europe by excluding Russia. And there will be no lasting peace in the world by excluding Russia. Whether you like Russia or not, that's another thing. But you need to deal with Russia as it is. You cannot fantasize about Russia. You cannot come up with conspiracy theories about Russia, etc. When Russia moved into Ukraine, they want to stop Ukraine from becoming a NATO member state. Why should they do that? Let me cite the example of your former country. For example, when the Cuban crisis broke out, the former Soviet Union was a sovereign country.
Yes.
Cuba was a sovereign country. So why should the United States and President Kennedy jump out of the seat crying foul and try to stop the Soviet Union deployment of missile in Cuba. Because President Kennedy and the United States felt legitimately threatened.
Yes.
If there will be Soviet missiles deployed in Cuba, yeah. Not in Florida.
Right.
So I think Europeans need to really have second thoughts about what President Trump, President Putin and the Russian government feel about if Ukraine really become a NATO member state. Probably the Russian leaders will feel exactly what
President Kennedy felt. Yes.
When the Soviet wanted to deploy missiles in Cuba.
In fact, at that very time, just prior to the incursion or the special operation, as the Russians call it, the NATO troops, along with heavy forces of American troops, and I remember talking about this openly, were doing military exercises in the Black Sea within eyeshot of Russian tourists on the beach watching it. It's like, could you imagine if China were doing military exercises in the Gulf of Mexico or off the coast of New York or off the coast of Miami Beach?
Or in the English Channel, for example.
Or in the English Channel. It's almost like, do you not see how others might be affected by that? I mean, it's almost the definition of obnoxiousness, and sometimes I think countries behave that way. Let's switch from Russia now and talk about Mr. Modi. The Prime Minister of India has done some remarkable things lately. There are reports that Mr. Trump tried to reach out to him three or four different times post the threat about the 50% tariffs, and Mr. Modi refused to take his calls. Instead, he wanted to be talking to the Mr. Xi, and instead he sent his foreign minister the next day to talk to China. How do you characterize that?
Well, I would say Prime Minister Modi was warmly welcomed in Tianjin when he attended the SCO summit. It was a great breakthrough in China-Indian relations. I think the way President Trump handled or mishandled India was completely...
Mishandled.
Yeah. Or manhandled India was completely a dishonorable thing. He called the Indian economy as a dead economy. No, the Indian economy is not dead. It's very lovely, lively, and it has a great potential. So I think for the United States to reveal its real color, to call India and to deny any respect for India is really one of the worst things I've seen in recent years. Of course, India is a great country, 5,000 years of history, they say 8,000 years of history, and one of them even said 10,000 years of civilization.
Yes.
They would not bow to President Trump or call him uncle, for example, as some of the European leaders now have become accustomed to call President Trump a daddy. And I think in the worst day, I was interviewed by a major Indian television, and I said the right thing about what India should do. They should have all the respect and appreciation and admiration, for example, unlike what President Trump is doing to India. I was hailed as a hero in India. Lots of people say, this guy from China is saying the right thing. That was before Prime Minister Modi's decision to go to Tianjin to attend the SCO summit. I would say between China and India, I've called both of them superpopulations, meaning...
2.8 billion people.
Exactly. If a country has more than 1 billion people, I will call it a superpopulation. So there are only two superpopulations in the world, India and China. We have tremendous amount of responsibility for our own people, for each other, and for mankind as a whole. So we need to really size up the situation, re-engage with each other, and put the territorial disputes behind us, and really create a momentum where China, India, and all the other members of SCO can work together in great friendship and cooperate to make sure that our future will be brighter and more promising in the future.
You and I both share something. You, of course, much more sophisticated than I, but we both have some experience on Wall Street. You were an investment banker with Morgan Stanley. I helped to take and found a publicly traded company in the United States. So as I'm looking at this scenario that we see right now between India and China, I'm thinking that from an investment standpoint, the biggest damage they can do to the West is not necessarily through weapons or any of these things that we saw in this parade. It would be through affecting the U.S. currency. it would be by changing or altering or maybe even showing a lack of respect for the U.S. banking system, et cetera, and creating its own alternative for the future. Do you think that's the plan? Can they pull it off?
Well, if you keep your ear very close to what the SEO members have been talking about, and lots of different proposals, some saying come up with a SEO currency,
yeah.
Some come up with a settlement or payment system suitable for SEO, etc. China has been more cautious. China always wants to do everything, every vetting, every investigation beforehand, exhausting all the possibilities before they take anything very dramatic or drastic, for example. So I think there is a balancing process within SEO, because SEO is completely on a consensus basis. But I think the fact that SEO wants to set up this SEO development bank is a right step in the right direction. Why? Because once you have a development bank, if you want to do something related to the currency or the payment system or settlement system, it will be much easier. And this will pave the way to future more explorations and experiments about many other things involving the financial restructuring.
But explain that better to me. I don't understand. Because as I see it, a development bank is just a fund that would allow others to be able to tap into that fund so that they can develop their countries, their infrastructure, et cetera. Wouldn't you need to go further? Because with that development fund, they're still using the SWIFT banking system. They're still using the U.S. dollar. How do you get from going beyond a development bank to something which is more significant?
First of all, purely from my perspective,
yes.
You know, using the dollar is not a problem. Using the SWIFT system is not a problem. The problem is that if the United States wants to weaponize the dollar, or if they want to weaponize the SWIFT system...
And they have, they have.
That creates a problem. They did this against Russia. They may do this against China. They may do this against India. They may do this against Brazil. Holy cow, this is very dangerous. That means you, by taking this very risky step, destroying your own trustworthiness, destroy your own reliability. That forces other countries, your counterparties, to be creative, to really go to the edge of the envelope and try to come up with something alternative. So I would say,
wow,
if SEO as a whole try to come up with something other than the dollar, it's not because they want to do that. It's because they were forced by Washington to do that. If they eventually come up with, let's say, a payment system, separate system outside of the SWIFT system, it's because someone weaponized the SWIFT system. That's one thing.
I've never heard it put that way. And I think that's so brilliant, the way you've just explained that. Because what you've just said to our audience, the millions of people who are going to be watching or are watching this conversation, and we're so glad that you're there, is there's nothing wrong with the SWIFT system. There's nothing wrong with the dollar.
No.
There's nothing wrong with what the United States and the West has put in place. It's only when you abuse it that it loses its credibility, and then it becomes to come into question.
Well said. Well said.
I'm a student. It's like you're my professor.
You're my teacher.
I want to go to your class. This is so fascinating. Uh-huh. Okay, now let's follow the enthymeme, if you will, the logical enthymeme of what were to happen if enough of these countries here, and we're watching this happen, Mr. Putin mentioned it just the other day, come together and say, finally, we are going to do this. We're going to develop a currency. We are going to develop a banking system. We are going to develop a developmental system which will challenge, if not maybe even compete and defeat, the one that's presented by the West. What happens to the West?
Well, let me use the United States as an example. You know, ever since April the 2nd, which President Trump called a liberation day, I really do not know liberation from what. He launched the largest scale tariff war against the rest of the world. But he completely forgets one thing.
Yes.
That is, for the United States to have a dominant dollar and to have the United States suffering a trade deficit, this is both conditional to each other. If you want to have a dominant dollar, then by logic, you need to run into a trade deficit. Now, President Trump wants to reverse it. He wants to have manufacturing done inside the United States.
Yes.
They no longer need to buy all things produced abroad. That means the trade deficit will diminish. Eventually, it will be reversed into a surplus. But then the other side of the coin is more important. What about the dominance of the dollar? You need to give up the dominance of the dollar. So I think President Trump has not figured out what he really wants. He wants to have shoemaking manufacturing job back to the United States, toy making back to the United States, or he really wants, as I used to be educated and trained for in the Morgan Stanley style, always see the juggler, always see the prime of the prime. That is the financials, the investment banking, the private equity, and now the stability dollars, for example. So I think President Trump is contradicting himself. He really creates a situation where eventually the dollar dominance may decline and the manufacturing going back to the United States may or may not happen, and the United States will lose out on one front or on both front. That's the problem, I would say.
Maybe we start to finish up the conversation with the following. I think the underpinnings of this conference, this summit, are as transformational as any summit that has taken place in the last several decades in the world. How much of a difference do you think, in the end, when historians look back at this, they'll see?
Well, I would say when future generations look back at the world of today, they most likely will see this SEO summit as what we now look back at the Cairo conference, Cairo Declaration, or at the Yalta conference, for example, which paved the way for ending the Second World War. Now, for the SEO summit this time, I think several messages come out. We definitely want to maintain the multipolarity as the structure of the world. We will not tolerate any country to claim to be the sole polarity in the world.
Right.
That's number one. Multilateralism should be encouraged rather than being muffled, for example. And then every country, big or small, needed to be treated as an equal. So we will not like the world where rule of the jungle will prevail. You hold a gun at my head, and I will call you uncle, surrender,
is
for
that
example.
How China, is that how China feels right now?
Well, China will never allow any country to hold a gun at my head without I hold a gun at your head.
Yeah.
So that's the way. Quid pro quo.
Do you think Mr. China. Xi feels that way based on the comportment of the U.S. government and Mr. Trump?
No, I think ever since the outbreak of the trade war, the tariff war, people are asking who blinked first. Let me tell you, very honestly, China didn't blink. Who blinked? You know the answer. I do not want to name that great gentleman. I do not want to name that great country. But China didn't blink. China stood very firm, tit for tat. If you want to increase tariff to 145%, China increased the tariff up to 125%, tit for tat.
But this is the common theme here. Think about it, Victor. Russia didn't blink. China didn't blink, and now India didn't blink. Yeah.
Brazil didn't blink.
And Brazil didn't blink when they said that, you know, we're going to tariff you if you don't end the trial for the former president, which is a completely political assertion.
South Africa also didn't blink. South Africa.
Wow.
So all these are founding members, or the first batch of members of the SEO organization.
It's the no-blink society.
No-blink
society.
No blink.
It's amazing, but it really comes to fruition, and it comes to fruition here with all of these no blinkers together.
No blinkers, but also they no blink because of the SEO. Give them strength and give them wisdom. Give them the platform to cooperate. And the cooperation is not against the United States. The cooperation is against whatever if the United States is doing the wrong thing.
So you think that Mr. Trump and the United States policies have brought these countries together? Best example of it, I think, is China and India.
India.
There's always been a little bit of an antagonism there. Not horribly, horribly overheated. At times, yes. But now it looks like they're besties all of a sudden.
Yeah, exactly. But the point I've been telling my Indian friends is that with or without the United States, China and India will have all the incentive to re-engage with each other anyway. And what President Trump did to India, manhandling or abusing India, give greater incentive for both of us to size up each other, to recognize that we are not enemies against each other and we can be partners going forward.
I'm wondering, Mr. Putin, I'm told by my producers, will be speaking shortly. He's going to make his statement post-summit. What do you expect to hear from Mr. Putin?
Well, I hope President Putin will say several things, that the world we are living through is a multipolar world, and we want to welcome and fully embrace multilateralism, and we want to make sure that no single country will pretend to be the bully on the block or to claim itself as the emperor of the world. No, that's not a good, constructive, or healthy system for Russia, for China, for India, for all the member states of the Global South, all the member states of SCO. And we want to have a more normal and more constructive and more friendly, more respectful and more decent world order.
So what you're talking about is breaking the hegemony. And to break the hegemony needs to accept the fact that it's been broken. I don't think the U.S. is in a position, at least right now, to want to give that up. How long will they try and hold on to this power?
Well, if you listen to Elon Musk and believe in what he said, Elon Musk kept saying by the middle of this century, the size of the Chinese economy will be double the size of the United States. So that may or may not happen that early or that sooner, but it's going in that direction.
Sure is.
So I hope the United States will realize to treat China as an enemy is not in the fundamental interests of the American people. The better way is to deal with China, deal with countries like Russia, like India, like Brazil, like South Africa, like all the other SCO members, as they are. Show respect to all these countries. Deal with them as they are, rather than fantasizing about them or completely distort their realities.
Won't it be in the end the investment bankers like yourself, the guys over at Bank of America, BOA, and Morgan Stanley, and all these other places who will have to accept the fact that they need to deal with China and India because their economies are just too big?
Absolutely. I think
that's where it'll happen.
Firms like Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs started to move into China market as early as in the 1990s.
Yeah.
And they really profited hugely by engaging with China. And I hope other industries in the United States and Europe will continue to acknowledge this fact, very important fact.
I have some sources in the energy industry, both in Russia and in the United States, and I'm hearing same thing is happening there. A lot of the big companies in the energy district, energy region, are courting Russia, trying to get back together with the Gazproms and the Nexans to try and create the relationships that they've had in the past, like BP and Exxon, for example. So interesting, it kind of goes in line with what you just said. Deep down, the bankers in the West know that this is coming and they need to make it happen. They're way ahead, usually, of the politicians, I've always found. The business community is always ahead of the politicians.
I agree.
And they probably will, if it moves in that direction, it'll move in that direction, spearheaded by that group of people. Am I wrong?
I completely agree with you. I think as far as China-US is concerned, those politicians in the United States which hate China the most never run a business. They never made their money in an honorable, decent way.
Yes.
If they have a business in their family, they will not be that hawkish against China. They will know that the China market, despite of all the problems, is a market, the largest market in the world. You need to nurture the market. You need to engage with the market. And you need to make a profit out of that market.
Yeah. Did you hear that, folks? Did you hear that, America? Did you hear that, UK? Did you hear that, Germany? France? Are you listening to this conversation? Here's a Chinese person schooling us on the practicality of what is proper capital when infused into a political system to make it successful for the people. I think that's a heck of an argument. I also think it's a wonderful place to finish. You are a remarkable man.
Thank you, Rick. You are my hero.
No, sir. I am so lucky to have this conversation with you.
Thank you.
You're smart. You've taken us through so many topics.
Thank you.
Let's help. Oh, wait. No, we do it this way, I think, now, right? Right, we do it with the boom, right?
I will show respect for an American citizen.
You, sir, are wonderful.
Thank you.
And let's keep in touch. There's a lot of things happening, and I think it's important. Yes, thank you once again.
Thank you.
And that's it for us. Thank you, Mr. Gao. It's just been a pleasure. And what we're expecting now, just from a programming note, we're expecting that President Putin will be speaking at some point tonight. He's had several bilateral meetings with different leaders from around the world today. And the most, probably the most formidable, or the one that's going to be making all the headlines, is his meeting with the leader of North Korea. We expect that he will likely make some comments regarding that. If he does, obviously you can expect to see that right here as we'll cover it live. For us, that's it, though. I'm Rick Sanchez. And I'll tell you, It has been an absolute delight, both from a human standpoint and from a journalistic standpoint, to be here and watch these transformations unfold as the world, at least from an economic standpoint, seems to be changing before our very eyes. Thank you so much for letting us come into your homes and sharing whatever wisdom we've been able to bring. We'll see you next time. I'm Rick Sanchez. Good night.